to the Global Recon Podcast. Here are your hosts, John from Global Recon and Mike from Fieldcraft LLC, giving you the matter of facts.
Fieldcraftsurvival.com, globalrecon.net. I'm your host, John Hendricks. I'm here with your co-host, Mike Glover. We have an interesting guest on for today's episode. And we received some emails, some direct messages relating to fitness and how can guys prepare and increase their performance levels. So we're going to respond to some of those questions as well as give you guys some tips towards the end of the episode. So be on the lookout for that. Mike, I'll hand it over to you.
Hey, guys. It's Mike from Fieldcraft. Great to be on the podcast again. Just as far as the analytics we're looking at, the podcast is doing really well on iTunes and SoundCloud. We appreciate you listening in. Today, we're pretty privileged to have an active U.S. Army aviator. Goes by the name of Scott. He was a warrant officer who flies Kiowas. And Scott is currently doing the transition from Kiowas to Apaches because the U.S. Army right now is downsizing, or because of budget cuts, probably more political reasons than we want to dive into. They're transitioning into different platforms. So, Scott, you there? You on the mic?
Yeah, I'm here, man.
Hey, good to have you on, man. I think the first question is just if you can tell the listeners about yourself and kind of how I know you got a pretty dynamic story about how you became an aviator, but if you can, just give us a quick bio and a snapshot about your career thus far.
Yeah, absolutely. I just want to thank you guys for having me on, first and foremost. So hopefully I can do the whole KW community some justice here. But so my name's Scott. Currently been serving for 17 years. I was a prior service infantryman, kind of started out about 98. I came in, I was actually mechanized infantry, and then I got stationed up at Fort Lewis. Once we finished out the mechanized stuff, we kind of started that medium weight striker brigade. After we did that, I moved over to a sniper section, and kind of from there, that's where I stayed, really. I was kind of grew up in the sniper section, went to some schools, went through sniper school, graduated Army Sniper School, and from there I moved over to Italy, where I was part of the 173rd Airborne Brigade. Did a deployment with them in Iraq, and early on in Iraq at the beginning of the war, and then a deployment to Afghanistan with them. Basically, I was just a sniper team leader for the two deployments. Kind of in the later half of the Afghanistan deployment, I got promoted, so I ended up taking a platoon as a platoon sergeant. And when we came back from the back-to-back deployments, the Army started kind of moving a lot of us around. It had deployments into training positions to, go and share our knowledge with other people. So I ended up getting stationed in Fort Polk, Louisiana as a, good times, as a observer controller. So, I got to go down there and see a lot of the units come through, So in Fort Polk at JRTC, it's the Joint Readiness Training Center. It's where all the units have to come through to kind of prove themselves for combat, if you will. So we tried to provide the most real world scenario we could, for units coming through. And so I was part of a team that would observe units, and we'd conduct, pretty in-depth after action reviews for them and kind of give them some pointers on how things they did well and what they could do better. And then that just kind of started wearing on me a little bit. And so I decided to go ahead and drop my flight packet. I'd been sitting on it for a while, didn't know if it was something I wanted to do. And I knew that when it came time for me to get out, that I would probably need a little bit more than just being a regular infantry guy. So I tried to, put some more tools in my kit bag, if you will. And so I dropped my flight packet and got selected to go to Warrant Officer Candidate School in 2008. And from there, just went through flight school. I was there at Fort Rucker for 2 years, got all our primary stuff out of the way. And then I decided to select Kiowa Warriors as my advanced airframe and went through that, learned how to fly that, and then got stationed in my first unit over in Fort Bragg. And I was there for about 4.5 years, and then came out here to where I am now, and never thought I'd be retiring the Kiowa, but our unit has already flown them down to Davis Monthan in Arizona to the boneyard and shrink wrapped them up. So I'm just waiting on my transition now.
Wow. So that's so for our listeners who don't know, I mean, this is a, I would imagine, just from my understanding of and experience with military aviators, that, you know, Scott's story going from a soldier to a leader to a, you know, being a U.S. Army sniper to being a leader and, you know, being a platoon sergeant. You were a sergeant first class, right? You were an E-7 at that time. And then transitioning into a mentor position where you're teaching, you got kind of like the full scope of really like tapping out your operational career in the infantry, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there were definitely, you know, some other avenues I could have, you know, taken as far as, you know, advancing my career, but in the enlisted side. But I think at that point, like you said, I was kind of tapped out a little bit. I just, you know, I had gone from being the private to, you know, doing everything somebody told me to do to, you know, being that guy that was able to kind of teach and mentor the younger guys. And I think at that point, it just kind of, I don't want to say that, you know, I was tapped out on teaching and mentoring by any means, because, you know, I always love doing that. That's one thing I do love about the military. And even as a warrant officer, I can continue to do that. But, yeah, I just decided, man, I probably need to do something a little bit different, because it was kind of wearing on me a little bit.
So what is the Scott, for people who don't know, and even me, I like education on it. What is the warrant officer rank? Because, you know, for listeners who don't know about the military, you have the enlisted, you know, ranks from E1 to E9 in every service, you know, Navy, Army, Marines, and then Air Force. But then you have the officer branches or officer corps, and it goes from O1, you know, to general staff. Now, what is the warrant officer? I mean, is there a technical definition or I know, yeah, they're experts in their technical field, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's the thing about the warrant officers. We are the tactical and technical experts in our field. And there's, you know, kind of like with we call them RLOs, you know, the regular officers, the real life officers is what we call them. But, you know, like the lieutenants up through general, you know, they, you know, we have our branches and that warrant officers, you know, you have aviation, you have maintenance, you have supply and things like that. So there are what we call walking warrants, and then there's what we call aviation warrants. And we all have different MOSs, but, you know, I think the broadening definition for warrant officer is, you know, we are the tactical and technical experts in our field, and we're the ones that people go to when they really want to know what it is about that certain field, you know, because we just, you know, like I said, we're kind of the experts in that.
Yeah, I know, for guys and gals who don't know, in special forces, when you become a warrant officer, I mean, the bottom line is typically it's because they want to get more operational time, and they're usually prior enlisted special forces guys who transition into a warrant officer field, which is the technical term is a 180 alpha, and they act as the warrant on the team. They act as almost like the mediator and have the expertise and their specific field. Now, is it typical to be prior enlisted to be a warrant officer? Is that like a requirement?
No, it's definitely not a requirement. You know, and I'll just kind of stick with the flight aspect of it, because I you know, that's more the side I know. But I think you'll see more prior enlisted in the walking warrant side. It's actually technical warrant is what they're called. You know, with those branches, most of those people that go from prior enlistment to that technical warrant, they stay in the same branch. So they like to have that prior service knowledge of whatever branch they're going into. And with aviation, it differs a lot, because, you know, going through flight school, I remember when I first got there, I kind of thought that. I thought, oh man, yeah, you got to be prior service, you have to do this. But no, they have a lot of different guys coming over from different branches. I know I went through flight school with some Air Force, former Air Force guys, some former Navy guys, former Marine Corps guys. And then they have what's called high school to flight school or street to seat. They have guys that come straight off the street, and they put them in the helicopters, and you know that's their first experience in the Army. I mean, they go through basic and AIT, and then they come straight to Fort Rucker for warrant officer candidate school.
Now, officers can become pilots as well, right? Is there a officer pipeline for flight school?
Yeah, they definitely can. That's one of the branches for officers, and I'm not sure how it works on that side for them when they go to select their branch. I don't know if it's based off of order of merit list or how it works, but there is definitely we have officers within aviation, and the officers they fly. They don't fly as much as the warrants do, I think, because a lot of it has to deal with them, in their promotion pipeline. As they make rank, they have to fulfill certain requirements, and staff positions and things like that. So as they, keep getting promoted and taking different positions, ultimately, their goal is to take command of an aviation unit. So, their flying hours aren't nearly as much as what it would be for the warrant officers. So, that's the nice thing about, being a warrant officer and a regular line pilot is we get to fly a lot. So
you guys can stay operational and kind of avoid the staff realm that everybody kind of dreads.
Yeah, you can. And it's, we have to do it at some point as you continue to make rank. There's definitely those slots that you have to fill at the higher levels. But, depending on what unit you're flying with or who you're flying for, you can definitely still get your flight hours in.
Well, let's talk about flight school, man. A lot of people, and it's interesting because I know me and John don't deal in this realm, but it's interesting to hear because I don't know a lot about it. I remember in 2007, I had a CW-5 from 160th from the Night Stalkers who wrote a letter of recommendation for me to go to flight school because me and another guy wanted to be 86 pilots. We wanted to fly the little black Ferraris that had guns attached to them and kill bad guys. It seemed like such a good gig, but looking into it, we started doing research on flight school and it seemed like a pretty tough deal. How long is flight school and what's your take on it, man? Was it a good experience?
Yeah. I mean, flight school overall is a great experience. It was, everybody's experience differs, I guess, and that's as with everything in life. But, being prior service, you kind of get thrown into a mix of, like we talked about, there's just a bunch of different people there. So it's a pretty much a melting pot of, all these different walks of life. So you kind of have to reset your mind frame a little bit, coming from where I came from in the infantry and what we did, and then you kind of get into this realm of where there's a little bit more relaxation and things like that. So you have to change your mindset a little bit, but, flight school overall, it's difficult. I graduated high school and that was it at that point. So I went into it and I really didn't have a lot of good study habits. And that's kind of what you need going through flight school. I had gone to Pathfinder school and I think that helped out a little bit because, the attrition rate in that course when I went was really high and it helped me develop good study habits, but not to where I needed to be. So flight school is a lot of dedication to learning your craft. I mean, and you do it I would say based on what airframe you choose, you're there at Fort Rucker, anywhere from a year, year and a half to 2 years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay, so you said pick your airframe. So do you have the choice to pick what helicopter you want to fly?
Yes, you do. So everybody goes through the basic, flight school portions, which is called you have primary, and I'm sure they've changed a lot of it now, but you have primary, which everybody learns on the same aircraft. You got to learn how to hover. You got to learn how to fly. You got to do all that. They're definitely not going to throw you in the advanced airframe and teach you how to do that, but so we learned on the Bell 206s that was a little TH-67 Creek. They're we call them the orange creamsicles because they were painted like a, white and orange, and you could see them coming from a mile away. You knew there were some student pilots in the area, so watch out. But you learn that stuff, and they take you. They got all these little, side airfields all over the place, and you go out and you just sit there until you figure it out, and then you know, your instructor pilots, and we had a bunch of old crusty instructor pilots. I mean, these cats were flying it, you know, in Vietnam and things like that. So you can imagine they're, you know, they weren't too keen on, you know, just sitting there watching you jack stuff up. So, you know, they'd get pretty frustrated at times. But yeah, so you go through that primaries, I think it's 8 weeks, and you go through instruments where you learn how to fly in the clouds, bait, and, you know, fly off your instruments on your dashboard. And then that's another, I believe, 8 weeks. And then you go into what's called BWS, which is basic warfighter skills. And that's where you, you know, you got, you're pretty much not flying at that point. You're sitting in the left seat navigating off of maps in the cockpit. And, you know, you're doing time on target stuff. So you go through all that. And then, you know, based off your test scores, your PT score and everything, it's culminating. They build the order of merit list. So where you stand in the order of merit list is where you'll end up when you go to pick your airframe. And what they do is they pull you into a big classroom, and based off the needs of the Army at that point, they'll bring out this big dry erase board and they'll say, okay, we have this many Blackhawks, this many Chinooks, this many Apaches. And at the time it was this many Kiowas. Well, our class only had 3 Kiowas. And I think we were roughly about 20 people per class, or maybe more. Yeah. I think we were more. And, you know, it was on you at that point. You know, where did you leave yourself in the order merit list? And luckily I was pretty fortunate to be number 3 in the class. So I took my Kiowa and watched everybody else, you know, fight to get what they wanted. So
tell me the inside scoop. What's the priority list? I mean, are there dudes, I would think that like the Chinook, we call them shit hooks. I mean, that's like for the most part a transport kind of helicopter. Is that at the bottom of the list? Is there like a priority list of helicopters?
Man, it's funny, everybody you talk to, and that's the beauty of aviation. I think we all have our own demographic, and we all kind of have our own communities, if you will. And you know, there's guys that are sold on, hey, I'm picking the Blackhawk from day one. You know, they were former crew chiefs on a Blackhawk. And there's guys that are sold on picking Chinook from day one, and, you know, so forth. But it's funny to see guys that ask, they just absolutely do not want to fly a certain helicopter, and they will go kicking and screaming because, unfortunately, they didn't help themselves out on the OML list. So they end up getting stuck with whatever's left over. But now, you know, it's funny, the Chinooks went fast. I remember in our selecting class, because they only had, I think, 2 of them, but they went, I think they were the top 2 to go.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
The
Apaches and Blackhawks kind of, you know, they were filtered out towards the last half of the class, but.
Oh, that's crazy to hear. Cause I would think, I mean, when you have like a infantry combat arms kind of experience, I'm thinking I want whatever has got a gun on it. I don't want anything that I'm transporting anybody. And that's kind of crazy, man. I think from your experiences, now I have worked with Kiowas downrange. And for people who don't know, Kiowas support the warfighter, correct? I mean, they're supporting their reconnaissance aircraft and platform, but they also support directly the ground troops on the ground in close air support. Is there as much detail as you can give us without going overboard, can you give us like kind of like the capabilities of the Kiowa for guys and gals who don't know?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Kiowa Warrior is a scout reconnaissance platform. You know, I was kind of talking to John a little bit before we started up, but you know, we are an armed helicopter, but our sole purpose is to support the ground fighter. And I think that's what makes us unique as the Kiowa Warrior community, is we had a very close relationship with the people that we supported on the ground. No matter where we were at, what we were doing, we would always make it a point to, if we could, land, shut down, go over, shake hands, talk to people. You know, we were constantly looking for work. And I think that's what's unique about us. And not only that, is just the pilots that flew the helicopter. I don't think it was, you know, a lot of it had to do with the mindset of Kiowa Warrior pilots, and, you know, not just the machine. It was an amazing aircraft, and it did exactly what we asked it to do for many years. I think last count from Bell, we were, I think, over 900,000 combat flight hours in Kiowas. So, I mean, it's been an amazing helicopter. But, yeah, we're an armed reconnaissance platform. We conduct close combat attack for any ground forces that are in need. You know, we could be armed with rockets, Rocket 50, Rocket Hellfire. I mean, there's a plethora of, you know, different combinations we could use. And, you know, we carried 7-shot rocket pods and the 50 cal. That was a great gun that we had on the aircraft, and then Hellfires as well. So we had a lot of different capabilities. We had sensors that we could look and, you know, do a lot of different things with. But as far as being, you know, technologically advanced, we just weren't there like the Apache and the Blackhawks and the Chinooks and things like that. You know, they have what's called, you know, glass cockpits, if you will. But, you know, we just didn't have a lot of the stuff they had with them. So, you know, it was
which
a lot.
Comes with it. There's like an advantage and disadvantage to that, right? I mean,
yeah, I it's funny because I always like to say we're the only ones that really fly our helicopter. But just because, you know, there's a lot of things that, you know, are in these advanced airframes that, I mean, you really, it's just crazy nowadays.
It's automated, right? It's an automated system.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's, you know, kind of push a button and here you go. But yeah, we flew our helicopter. I mean, constantly your hands were on the controls and you were, you know, we were very power limited. So we had we were the only single engine aircraft in the Army inventory as far as advanced airframes went at the time for the big Army. Obviously, you know, regiment and those guys have their own thing, but we, you know, we had a single engine and, we were power limited. So, you know, we used to get it a lot of flack, you know, we were kind of the brunt end of a lot of jokes and things like that. But, you know, people were like, oh, you guys won't be able to, you know, fly in Afghanistan and things and that. I mean, but you know, we flew a lot, you know, in a lot of these places where people thought the 58 wouldn't be able to fly. So,
Now you guys are armed with M4s inside the cockpit. Is that right?
Yeah, that's one unique thing about the KW is we were very proficient with M4, and you know, to reduce collateral damage if need be, you know, we get pretty accurate with that thing, and we could, you know, we could put rounds on target with M4 out the door. I know a lot of KW pilots who are very proficient with making things happen, you know, using their M4 out the door. So that's one thing, you know, unique thing that we brought to the battlefield. You know, we used to fly with our doors off all the time. It didn't matter if it was, you know, negative 20 degrees outside or what, we would fly with our doors off. You know, we'd bundle up, but, you know, we could mark targets, we could drop smoke, you know, we could do a lot of things for the ground guys. And like I said, I just think, you know, that uniqueness that we brought to the battlefield and that close relationship we had with the ground guys, I think it, you know, made for a combat multiplier, definitely.
Now you being an Army sniper, being an infantryman and having all that experience, how do you think that helped you compared to your peers? Was it the verbiage? I mean, you guys spoke the same language. I mean, you understood how ground operations were conducted. Was that a big benefit for you? And is there any kind of like stories from war or anything that comes to mind where maybe that was a benefit?
Yeah, I think overall it definitely helps. You know, just coming from the background I came from and knowing, I guess, you know, talking to aircraft before or even just talking on radios in general, because what a lot of times, you know, you get a lot of guys that haven't been prior service or done a lot of, you know, time talking on the radios or things like that. And I think that's a one big thing, because that's our lifeline. That's our bread and butter, is being able to handle, you know, talking on the radios, because we have five of them at any given time going off in our headset. So we're managing, you know, and you're managing the battlefield. And it definitely had a huge impact, you know, being able to talk to guys, being able to kind of see the battlefield three-dimensionally, I think helped out a lot, you know, to kind of anticipate what the ground commander was going to do. And you were able to help guide him and move him around, you know, to things that he wouldn't be able to see, you know, without you there. So it definitely helped out a lot. I think it played a huge role. You know, and I think that's one big takeaway from combat experience that I've had, just in, I think overall in general, is being able to take that ground commander and, you know, move him and help him, you know, kind of maneuver and to get, you know, better eyes on, or just maneuver his element to a safer place, or even give him that breathing room that he needs for that 1 second to regroup and continue the fight, you know. So it definitely helped out a lot.
Yeah, no, I know, just from my experience working with Kyle, is just having the eyes in the sky, obviously, is just giving the ground commanders better situational awareness, but also you being a armed platform that can provide close air support or immediate QRF, immediate quick reaction force from the air, is a huge benefit for that ground force commander. And it seems to me, being in that platform, because I know I've read some 160th statistics that, you know, they're called night stalkers because they fly at night, and there's a reason for that, because, you know, flying that low in combat environments, you guys are easy targets. Was there ever a period of time where, I mean, you guys were in situations, or that you'd heard of guys in situations of Kiowas getting shot down or shot at? I mean, it seems like that would be a common thing, flying daylight and, you know, in the middle of gunfights. I mean, you're the biggest target for the bad guys.
Yeah, that's exactly what we do, you know, and we fly low, and, you know, not always. I think, you know, I want to give the perception that all we do is fly treetop level, but, you know, there's a time and a place for it. But, you know, absolutely, we can hear gunfire. And it's funny about being in the Kiowa is, you know, a lot of people, I've talked to other aviators, like, oh man, you can hear that? Yeah, absolutely. I can hear an AK-47 at 1,000 feet. You know, it's just very distinct and you can hear it. But yeah, being even lower than that, you know, if we're 200 feet, whatever. Yeah. You know, sometimes it called for us to draw fire, and we would do just that. We would set ourselves up to be the, I guess, I don't know, test dummy to draw the fire so we could figure out where guys were, and we'd do it. You know, we do it in a heartbeat because we knew that that it needed to be done. And I think that's, you know, something about, says a lot about the Kiowa pilots and their, I guess, grit, kind of what they were willing to do. They would put themselves, you know, the situations they would put themselves in to kind of help in any way they could. But yeah, there's definitely a few times. I remember once, you know, when we were deployed, you know, that was kind of our first couple of days in country, but we had a couple aircraft go out and they decided to get pretty low, and they came back pretty peppered up, but that's all right. We had some awesome maintainers that, man, if it wasn't for them, we definitely wouldn't be able to fly the amount of hours we flew. Those guys kept us in the air.
That's crazy. What kind of if this isn't an OPSEC thing, if it's not, don't worry about it. But what kind of rotations do aviators usually typically go on? I would imagine like a year rotation would be wearing on aviators who are constantly, you know, flying nonstop.
Yeah, so we would you know, year long tours, and it does, it wears on you because you're flying. It was weird because on the ground, you go out, you do your missions. I remember running a sniper team out there, and we'd go on our missions, and, you know, we'd be out for X amount of time and come back. But, you know, I always used to see the helicopters fly over, and I'm like, man, I wish I was going where they were going right now, you know, as I'm, you know, freezing, about to get hypothermia or whatever. But they, you know, we fly shifts, so whatever shift you were on, you know, you have to get used to that shift, and you'd usually change shifts every so often. But yeah, I mean, there's days when you're sitting 12 hours in that seat in that helicopter, and man, it beats you up. So yeah, it wears on you, and they have things in place that kind of keep us from flying too much and let us kind of reset a little bit, but yeah, you fly a lot. So
now, is it, we'd like to talk, I mean, we've had a conversation a couple of times, but let's talk about, like, how do you manage that with a family? You're married with kids, right?
I am. I'm married. We have one daughter, and it's, you know, when I was prior service, I wasn't, my wife and I actually met when I was stationed in Louisiana, and we ended up getting married there, and that's when I went to flight school. So, you know, it's hard. I don't say it's hard. You know, we have a very strong marriage. We've been actually through a lot, and it's trying. It's definitely trying. But But you manage, you know, and thankfully now, you know, you have all these Skype and everything in place to where you can, you know, be able to talk to your family and things like that. But, you know, there's those times where you can't contact the family for anything, you know, due to certain reasons, and it gets pretty, you know, people kind of start getting uneasy and things like that. But we manage, and, you know, like I said, it really, you have to communicate. You have to communicate. And I think that's what makes it big, is being able to talk, you know, to your significant other, your spouse, and really work things out. But you know, we've been able to do just that. And, you know, we haven't had any issues with it. So.
Well, kudos to you, man. I know, you know, I can't imagine, you know, special operations, I've done a lot of rotations, but they're shorter stints. And I can't imagine, and I talk to buddies about it all the time, doing a year downrange and how taxing that would be on a family. Especially in a situation where you're flying all those hours and they're combat hours. It's not like you guys are sitting in a fob, you know, sitting behind the wire. You're up in the air, a target, and you're involved in direct combat operations. So I know from everybody, you know, me and just me personally, me and John, thanks for your service, and thanks to your wife, who's, you know, obviously courageous to stand by your side all these years, and loyal. And it's awesome to hear, you know, a good story of a good family life.
No, it's my pleasure. I mean, you know, and I've been doing it for 17 years. I really don't see stopping anytime soon. So, and it's been good to me and my family so far. So we'll see how long we can ride it out.
That's awesome, man. And that moves us on to talking about the transition. Now, the Kyle was going away. It's packed out and it's done. It's hung up. So what are we doing now? I know you talked to me about transitioning into an Apache. That sounds like, you know, coming from somebody who's not an aviator, it sounds like a pretty painful but maybe, you know, joyous, adventurous adventure that you're about to get yourself into. Is that a long process?
So the transitions, it's a long process if you're, you know, one of the – so basically what they did is they took all the Kiowa pilots and they put us in a selection board. Because they didn't really know what they were going to do, so they ran us through a selection board and they looked at all our stuff. It was almost like running us through a promotion board, and they selected, you know, their top 100 and their alternative 100 and so forth, so on. But based off of that, you got your selection and your year date. So there's, you know, fortunately, I'm going this summer. There's some guys that are definitely having to wait, you know, a year or so more. But that's the long process. Part about it. As far as the transition itself, it's just, you know, kind of, I didn't even say changing a mindset, because we're not changing our mindset. We're bringing the Kiowa mindset to the Apache now. So, and I know that kind of might ruffle some feathers, and it already has a little bit, but that's who we are as aviators. You know, Kiowa warriors, we're air cab, we're scout pilots, and we've got a certain mentality, and we're bringing it to the Apache. So it's not learning how to fly all over again. So it's the transition isn't going to take too long. It's just now we're learning the specifics of the Apache, which is a very intense aircraft. And it was, you know, it's a very well designed aircraft for what it was designed to do. And it's just, there's a lot of systems involved that we're not used to. So
that's pretty cool. I think just making that transition into any airframe, just looking at it from the outside in, would be a pretty difficult one. But for an aviator, obviously, that you already are, moving from that to, you know, you being a technical, I think, you know, it's almost like you're an actual like race car driver that rides road courses, and now you're moving to like an F1 and things are automated, and it's like a, you know, it's like a fast mover. It's like moving from an A-10 aircraft, you know, that's cable controlled, then moving to a fast mover that's automated. Do you think that's going to be a tough transition for you, or you think are you looking forward to that transition and getting in that platform?
I mean, I'm looking forward to you know, flying again. That's first foremost. The Apache, it's kind of a love-hate thing. I know a lot of guys either love it or they hate it. I'm kind of in between on it. You know, it's there's a lot of maintenance involved with it. Definitely when you get into something that you know, that in depth of a helicopter, but it's you know, I'm definitely looking forward to it. I can't really speak a whole lot on it other than, you know, what I saw out of the guys I worked with when we were deployed. But I mean, it's an amazing aircraft. And yeah, like you said, I mean, the 58 was like a little, we were nimble, we were, you know, able to maneuver, and we're very, you know, we could do it quickly. You know, this is a bigger aircraft, so you got to remember, you got a lot behind you that you're pulling behind you a little bit. So it's a big aircraft. But yeah, I'm looking forward to it. It's I'm looking forward to the capabilities it has and being able to kind of put those to use, because I know they have some pretty awesome capabilities. So
awesome, man.
Yeah. So Scott, we actually have a Global Recon contributor. Her name is Adrienne Hatcher, and she was the first female Apache pilot in the Missouri National Guard. So we had her on for an episode, but it was more like of an interview about her. But I guess we can get her on for a later episode and maybe have you on, and you guys can kind of helicopter it up.
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so I think she flew the Apache for 8 years, and then she transitioned into another airframe. I forget which one it was exactly. But so, Scott, I know that you and your brother raised some money for a nonprofit last year.
Yeah, we did. So my brother, Shane, he runs a CrossFit No Surrender out of Covington, Louisiana. You know, just kind of how we got it started. He, you know, when my wife was diagnosed with breast cancer, he started running a fundraiser, which he does every year. He does 24 and 24, and he raises money every year for breast cancer. And, you know, he and I got to brainstorm, and you know, we were like, well, let's definitely look at something that's close to home for both of us. You know, he's a prior service vet. He did a lot of contract work as well. And, you know, it's PTSD is something that has kind of really hit us both personally and close. And I've seen a lot of my good friends go through it. So we decided, let's go ahead and, you know, raise some money. We weren't really sure, you know, how we were going to go about doing it or who we wanted to do, you know, the fundraiser for. So we reached out to a few places, and we found one that we felt comfortable with. And we went ahead and started setting everything up. Called it Miles to Go, just because I feel like, you know, we still have so much to do and so much we can do to help people out with battling PTSD, whether it be, you know, anybody, vets, you know, anybody that is, you know, puts it on the line every day. So we went ahead and started this fundraiser. So we started out in Covington, Louisiana. What we did was we asked people to raise money. We were going to do a 22-mile road march carrying 22 pounds, and we asked everybody that wanted to participate to raise $220. Now, we weren't turning anybody away, obviously, so if anybody wanted to participate, any donation would help. So we were actually able to raise over $11,000 for the organization, and, you know, it was just a really good turnout, and it just brought a lot of people together. I think that was one good thing about it, you know, not only helping, you know, an organization to help people that are going through stuff like that, but, you know, to be able to bring people together from all walks of life that can, you know, they walk, you know, 22 miles, man. People put their rucks on and they'd never done it before in their life. So it kind of gave them a little, you know, a little push, and man, it was pretty amazing to see. So
that's a huge gut check. That's awesome,
man. Yeah, big time. Yeah, so that's pretty awesome, man. That's very it's a great thing, and it's just amazing to see how people can come together around a good cause. And it's always something that we like to support, and you know, maybe we could do some stuff going down the line. So it's interesting. So you have a bit of a fitness background. I'm sure in order to maintain your readiness for deployments, you have to keep like a certain level of fitness, as Mike has stated in previous episodes and stuff like that. So I know, Mike, you got a couple of questions on DMs and emails, and so have I. So here's a question I wanted to bring up. I received this in a direct message, and here's what the guy said. I wanted to say I love the podcast. I'm prior active duty and now National Guard with a wife and children. I'm 36 years old, and in the last couple of years have fallen heavily out of shape. I'm finding it exponentially harder to find the motivation to get back into Army fit shape. I want to serve for as long as possible and don't want my body to be the reason I have to stop early. Any and all help would be greatly appreciated. I look up to and respect Mike and yourself immensely. So, Mike, what advice can we give this guy, and for anyone really who wants to get back into shape? That's a little bit of a different approach mentally to get back into shape.
Yes, so I think it's twofold. It's physical and mental, right? Because I'm the same age as this guy. I came in the Army at 17. You know, the Army will wear you out, and the hardest thing for me throughout my military career is the lulls that I've had, where I've kind of like come back from a deployment and I'm like, you know, I'm just gonna just get off my routine and just give myself my body a break, and then trying to get back into that routine, coming from a high state of physical readiness, and then just let myself go just a little bit. And you know, when I say let myself go, I mean, hey, I'm not gonna do a 5 mile run. I'm gonna do a 3 mile run, or I'm not gonna do a CrossFit workout. I'm gonna do a something a little bit more or less impact. So I was still active, but still trying to get to that optimal fitness level was difficult. So I talked to a lot of civilians at the gym that I go to about, you know, ways that they can get back into or get themselves into shape. And when you talk about this question, you know, he's asking how can he get into special operations, or to me, it's just Army shape, because the Army's going, once you get into the Army itself, as I stated in previous podcasts, your 25 meter target is basic training and AIT fitness. And then they're going to whip you into shape, and then you're going to advance and get more and more into shape. You know, basic training and infantry advanced individual training is a total of 15, 16 weeks. At least the last time I checked. So it's, you're talking about 15, 16 weeks of getting whipped back into shape. One thing is, you know, age, everybody knows this. It's obviously science, but we know this between the three of us, that being in your 30s, as you increase in age, you decrease your level of natural producing testosterone, which helps with recovery, helps with sleep, helps with regulation of basically all body and physical function. So a lot of people's advice would be, hey, just hit the gym harder, you know, eat better. And that's real easy to do. But I'm a little bit more surgical and deliberate about my actions when I look at this approach. So the number one thing I would do is go get my blood work done. If you Google blood work for athletes, there's different panels that you can get tested to see what you're lacking, because a lot of the times you might be deficient in something like a specific vitamin, a specific portion of your blood panel might show a deficiency that you can correct that actually will increase your ability to recover. Getting your testosterone checked out. I don't want to promote this, but I know there's a lot of guys getting it done, and I've seen the benefits. Obviously, it's like anything else, it could be abused, but there's all these testosterone shops that are opening up that offer, what do they call it? Testosterone therapy to increase levels of testosterone. Now, you can get this prescribed, which under a physician and the right way is they're doing your blood work. They're seeing your levels aren't optimal. They're getting you to an optimal level, which will obviously increase your ability to maintain muscle, recover from exercises, et cetera, et cetera. That would be, for me, I know it's kind of unorthodox, but for me, that would be the first approach, is to diagnose and can I get like a diagnostic panel of what is currently going on with my body and my system. The next thing is the physical fitness approach. Look, a lot of guys want to get dynamic when they look at special operations, physical fitness. You know, they want the answer, the golden key. There is no golden key. There is no golden answer. Even when we talk about objective fit, you know, I got a special forces buddy who runs a great program called Guerrilla Athlete. These are the programs that I recommend, because it's not one one solution is going to give you all the answers. It depend. There's a lot of questions that need to be asked from the trainer, from the coach, from the gym, from the facility before you can get anything specific. So I'll say that in physically, my recommendation is look at yourself and figure out what you have to do physically to get yourself back into shape based on your physical fitness level. I don't know this guy's physical fitness level, but I will tell you general fitness is the start to get him back, to whip him back into decent shape. He wouldn't be the guy I would recommend to maybe potentially go to a Gorilla Athlete or to go to CrossFit gyms and then break themselves off and then end up with bad mental results because they're like, man, I'm so out of shape. They get down on themselves and then they don't rebound appropriately. I would say, hey, you know, start with basic fundamentals and then work yourself into a basic workout. Now, John, we talked about calisthenic workouts. For me, physically, that's the best way to start because you're pushing and pulling your own body weight. You don't need a lot of equipment to do it. And we actually discussed a workout prior to this that might benefit this particular case. You want to talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So that's one thing I've experienced being in good shape, getting injured, falling out of good shape, and then having to get back into shape. So this is something that I've done a couple of times. So what I'll say on the matter is you want to start basic and don't try too much. Like Mike said, maybe you'll go to a program and you'll realize that you can't do as much as you thought or as much as the workout tempo requires, and then you get down on yourself. So you want to start small. And you want to start very basic, push-ups, pull-ups, or if you can't do pull-ups, you know, there's workouts you can work towards that'll help you work towards pull-ups. So I'm actually going to give you guys a basic calisthenic workout. And this is something that can be used at a very basic level. And as you improve your fitness levels, you can increase it using the same format that I'm going to give you. So basically, the workout is a combination of pull-ups, push-ups, dips, and squats, bodyweight squats. So what you do is you do one pull-up, one push-up, one dip, one bodyweight squat, and then two pull-ups, two push-ups, two dips, two bodyweight squats. And you just keep working up. And so if you're going to start, like for this guy who sent me this message, if you're going to start with this workout and your fitness level is low, just, you know, start up, go up to five and see how your body responds. If five hurts you and if five is a struggle, then you stop at five. Now, and you can keep going up. If you get to five and you feel like five, you still got some more in you, then go up to seven or go up to eight. And then you can take a break. You know, you take 15-minute break, 20-minute break after you reach your number. And then you can work down from that number. So if you get to seven, take a 20-minute break, and then start at seven. Do seven pull-ups, seven push-ups, seven dips, seven squats, and then work down. So you could do seven, then six, then five, then four, and so forth. So that'll be my advice. Like Mike said, you know, get your blood work done, figure out where your deficiencies are, and then that'll help map out your training path going forward.
I had another question from a guy whose name is Jake. And he was trying to train it up, and maybe Scott could chime in on this one. This guy is trying to improve his 2 mile run time, and I know a lot of guys talk about trying to improve their 2 mile run time because they want to improve. In the U.S. Army, it's a part of the Army physical fitness test, which, you know, is two minutes of push-ups, 2 minutes of sit-ups, and then a 2 mile run. Scott, just, you know, being in the Army and being part of that, I'm sure you guys have APFT requirements. And being a former infantryman is even more of a bonus. Can you give this guy advice on how you improve your 2 mile run time?
I'm a warrant officer. What's PT? No, I'm just joking, man. for real. I'm a real big fitness guy. And I love working out all the time. So, you know, that's actually, I recently was just trying to improve my 2 mile run time because, you know, I'd kind of fallen off a little bit just because our op tempo was real high. And so, and I think a lot of guys, they, for military anyway, you know, they get tunnel visioned on, oh, I just have to train, you know, sit-ups, push-ups, and a 2 mile run and things like that. And I think it kind of goes a little bit beyond that. But for running anyways, I mean, what I used to do, and I still do it, I like to kind of change it up a little bit. You know, I don't – anything over 5 miles for me is way too much. I mean, nowadays anything over 4 miles gets a little much. But I'll – you know, I will run that – you know, what I'll do is I'll kind of almost do a circuit style, but I'll do it with mile. You know, so I'll run 1 mile, you know, as fast as I can, and I'll rest for, you know, let's say 3 minutes. And then I'll run that mile again, and I'll give myself a goal to try to get underneath that time for that mile, you know, and then I'll rest again, and then I'll give myself another goal for the third mile. And usually I'll do it for like those 3 miles, you know, and it's not a dead sprint. I usually go to maybe, you know, I'd say probably about at 85%, you know, of my max, just so I'm not, you know, burning out all my, you know, oxygen in my lungs right away. But, you know, I'm pushing myself. So, and that really helped me. You know, I was able to drop my 2 mile run time from, I think it was 15 minutes, and I got it all the way down to, I think I was right at a 12:45. So I really did that circuit training a lot. And, you know, I would work sprints into it, but at the end of the day, not too many. But that really helped me a lot. Where if I was going to do like a 4 mile run, I would say, okay, hey, I'm going to run my first 2 miles at a, you know, whatever minute mile pace. And then I would increase my next 2 miles and I would try to hold a faster pace. So let's say my first 2 miles were a 7:45. Then my next 2 miles after that, I would try to run at like a 7:30 or a 7:25 just to, you know, and push yourself to do that. I mean, obviously I know those are, you know, high numbers or, you know, low numbers, but, you know, set those goals and then just try to get to them. But I think overall that helped me out a lot.
Yeah, it's funny because the guy who asked the question was also doing long runs, and then you said, you know, you don't run anything over 5 miles, and people need to understand that there are periods of time. It's hard. I remember training up for selections, and the selection requirements were high endurance, agility for long periods of time, whether it's a long range movement with a heavy rucksack. There is a difference. And we want to clearly delineate this. There's a difference between operator fit physical fitness levels and, you know, training up for a selection or being even a soldier in the regular army. So there's different levels. The same shape that you're going to be when you're trying to train up for selection is a completely different shape that you're going to be in when you're actually an operator. And I remember going to selection and having to drop 15, 20 pounds, or not having to drop, but just by default of the programs that I was doing, was, you know, I was walking long miles with a rucksack. I was running long distances because I knew I had to run long distances. But for these guys who were really looking at that 25 meter target, focus on, you know, like Scott said, like improving the 2 mile run with that specific goal in mind. And don't worry about, you know, the operator fitness. Worry about the 2 mile run. If you're trying to increase push-ups, look at the exercises, the push-up itself that's going to help you improve. Like John describes, you know, the calisthenics, pushing and pulling your own body weight. There are plenty of things that you could do to make you strong, and really that's the premise and kind of the model behind a lot of new functional fitness is. Look, you can go in the gym and do compound movements and make your muscles look bigger, but there's also a huge benefit in what we call functional fitness of pushing and pulling your own body weight at different angles, at, you know, and different movements at different intervals to be able to be functionally fit, which means you're basically, to me, it means that you're strong, but you're able to have the agility or the endurance to get through long duration physical fitness requirements. So, yeah, appreciate that advice, Scott, because a lot of people, you know, who aren't tied to the military don't really get to hear, you know, from, I'm so, I mean, I could do a wind sprint right now about 100 meters and destroy it. But after that, I think I'd be long winded. But I'm a different kind of shape than I was when I was in the regular Army, and that's going to vary depending on where you are. So that was a good insight. I know me and you had discussed this nonprofit that we wanted to benefit, and we had talked about moving forward and maybe the fall time, depending on your schedule, at your brother's gym. What's the name of your brother's gym?
Yeah, so my brother, Shane, he runs a gym. It's called CrossFit No Surrender. He started that. You know, he used to personally train a lot, but he wanted to get into something different. So he started that up. CrossFit No Surrender, and that's out of Covington, Louisiana.
And is there a website for that?
Absolutely. It's www.crossfitnosurrender.com. CrossFit No Surrender is all one word, no spaces. So,
and he's got an Instagram as well, right?
He does. It's at CrossFit No Surrender.
Awesome, man. A buddy of mine, and this is just maybe a warno on it, a buddy of mine who used to be a sniper with me in the SIF, he owns a CrossFit gym in North Carolina in Fayetteville called CrossFit Guild. And I don't know if you saw the comment, but I posted it on social media, and then he posted the comment, hey, I own the CrossFit gym, and I forgot all about him owning a CrossFit gym. But CrossFit, you know, I knock CrossFitters because some of it's funny. There's some funny memes out there, and it's funny, but the actual workouts and what they're putting out is, to me, a good product because it's high-intensity interval training. It's core functional movements. It's core lifts, and it does nothing but make you faster. And there's it makes you stronger. There's some debates whether it could potentially injure you, but I look at it, you know, at face value, just like anything else. You could get injured, you know, walking into your gym. You know, so if it fits the mold for the perfect representation of the kind of like nonprofit support we were looking for. And I thought, you know, I had an epiphany this morning just reading that comment that CrossFit is a franchise, correct? It's a franchise business, meaning you could get qualified and then you can get a CrossFit gym going through training. And I think that's how it works.
Yeah, they basically you go and you get your certification. I think they have a level 1, 2, and I think they're even working on a higher level cert now. But yeah, once you get that and you open up, if you use the CrossFit name, obviously, you know, you have to work it out with them. But yeah, they basically have a headquarters, and I think it's out in California. But yeah, so you're right. That's how it works.
So when I think about this, like, you know, obviously CrossFit being everywhere, and doing a fundraiser at a specific CrossFit gym, if we can get more CrossFit gyms maybe involved at the same time hack and maybe do the same workout of the day at the same time nationwide, that this could be something pretty big. And we can, and instead of it turning, you know, you guys did an awesome job of raising 11 grand, that maybe we could raise, you know, tens of thousands of dollars to go to a good cause, which is undetermined. But, you know, that's just something to think about and just me throwing out there. John, you got any input on that?
Yeah, I think I actually know one of my Bar Stars team members owns a CrossFit gym in New Jersey, which when you and Tool come to New York, one of the classes, the knife fighting classes, are going to be held in that gym. So, yeah, it's funny, coming from a calisthenic background, we kind of rib my friend a little bit. So I enjoy the philosophy of the training style of CrossFit, which combines calisthenics with powerlifting, you know, the squats, clean and press, things like that. So I think it has huge benefits. So in the whole fitness realm, there's always like the new trend or something new that's coming out, like and I believe the military PT tests are reflecting the changes of the times. My only thing that I absolutely, it annoys me about CrossFit is the pull-up part, but that's just because I'm a pull-up guy. And we in Barstars, we heavily emphasize on doing the strict form pull-ups. But everything else, I absolutely.
Oh, you're talking about the kip, like that, what they call it, a kip up, right?
Yeah. Yeah, so that's like looked down upon in that community. But everything else about it, I absolutely love. And I think it's a great thing that people are able to open businesses that benefit people's health. And a lot of what people don't really talk about much or realize is that when you have, like, let's say a CrossFit gym opens up and you get, you know, I don't know, 30 members or whatever, you now have 30 people who are going to be healthier, and long term, that's going to decrease the chances of them having health issues down the line. So if you open up 20 CrossFit gyms in a 50-mile, you know, in a 100-mile radius, you just opened up 20 centers that are going to decrease the health risk of all the members going for the future. So if, let's say, someone's 75 years old and they didn't have a job with a pension or whatever and all their health benefits, when they get sick and they go to the hospital, the taxpayers are footing that bill. And it's interesting, right now in Manhattan, elements of Barstars are in talks with the local government to set up more fitness parks and more and give people easier access to some fitness equipment. And we're going to try and run programs through the city where we teach free classes and things like that. And there are huge benefits for that. And I think it would be a great idea if we can actually get a bunch of CrossFit gyms nationwide to join in on Scott and his brother's fundraiser and just show people that we can do a lot when we all come together.
Yeah, I think that'd be awesome, man. I think the more the merrier, and more to follow with Scott and his brother Shane. We'll have some conversations offline. Before we close it out, man, I just want to give you guys a little tidbits and mindset. You know, we talk about physical conditioning, and I like to add, you know, mindset, because I think mindset is the most important aspect of physical conditioning. In fact, recently, I don't think we put this out there, but recently we had a professional baseball organization reach out to us and talk about that mindset and the application of warrior mindset in athletics. And me and John have some good ideas, as well as two from Rona Titus, talking about objective fit, about integrating warrior mindset into different programs. And I talk about survival psychology a little bit on my social media, on my blogs. And the problem that I see overarching with the whole PTSD, with the whole survival psychology, the whole realm is reactive. We're concentrating on an effort of diagnosing and trying to deal with symptoms instead of dealing with the actual issues. And people don't have a lot of tools to deal, like soldiers don't have the tools, aren't taught the coping mechanisms, aren't taught really a warrior mindset. So like when you got a guy like Scott, who was a U.S. Army sniper before he becomes a helicopter pilot, he is so much more mentally prepared to be in that cockpit and to get in a gunfight and get through that gunfight. And if something goes wrong, to deal with that after the fact. And the failure I'm seeing, you know, in really government organizations, to no fault of their own, it's the government, you know, it's temporary, it's always changing, nothing's really sustainable. There's a lot of organizations out there private organizations that are coming out with good solutions. I don't like to pimp my own company on this podcast, because it's not a place for me to pimp my organization. But some of the training that I do, one of the training courses that I offer is called the OPS course. But the acronym OPS is Observe, Prepare, and Survive. And we'll talk about the P and the S. But today, just real quick, I'll talk about the observe. And the ops process is what happens when you're confronted with an actual potential survival catastrophe, meaning something's about to go wrong. It could be a man-made or natural catastrophe. The first thing you need to do is observe, right? So if I'm in a school and an active shooter kicks in the front door and you hear a gunshot, you're not going to recognize that gunshot. And typically people don't, you know, from the psychological case studies that I've read and studied, most people don't recognize the signs of an actual catastrophe until literally it's too late, until the dude kicks in the front door of the classroom and now they're confronted with a gun and it's too late. They're going to potentially be killed. So the first thing to do,
go ahead, John. It's interesting you say that, is that when we had Alex Carlatos on a couple of episodes ago talking about that incident on the train in France, he said he heard what he thought was a gunshot and breaking glass, but he just thought nothing of it. And I just think it's interesting that you brought that up. And then when you brought that up, I remembered what he said. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, because he said he got tunnel vision and was completely focused on the task at hand, which is what happens when cortisol is dumped into your system. It starts reacting. You start narrowing your focus, and the extremities, your eyes, start focusing on the threat, and everything else starts lulling. And, you know, your vision, even lull, parts of your vision can lull. You'll lose, as he stated, his peripheral. So the first piece of that, like I talk about conscious and unconscious thought, and, you know, the observer and other podcast, the first aspect of that is observation. So it's almost like in an immediate action drill. In the infantry, Scott will know this from being in the infantry, when we take contact, the first thing we do is we have an immediate action drill, but we have to react accordingly. And typically when we receive the initial barrage of gunfire, we identify the threat and give direction and distance. That entire inject, you know, that training inject that we train soldiers to do is basically getting them to snap out of the actual gunfight itself, which is, you know, it's dangerous, people may die. But when it pops off, they start thinking. And the first thought is, I just received fire. I need to determine the direction and distance, and I need to announce that to my friends who have guns with me, and we need to lay down suppressive fire. So it's part of like an immediate action process. So when you look at a natural man-made catastrophe in the civilian world or the civilian realm, you have to get your mind to or train your mind to focus on the task at hand. The first part of that task is observe. You need to stop, look, and listen, and you need to definitively understand what's happening. And a lot of people die in survival type situations or catastrophes because they freeze. Inaction, and I say this all the time, hope is not a course of action. Wishful thinking is not a course of action. Freezing and thinking about it is not a course of action. If you hear something that's out of the ordinary, if you have a feeling that's out of the ordinary, listen to your instincts. Those mechanisms that are inside your person, inside your body, are natural mechanisms. Listen to them and then follow through with something. Any reaction, any action, just like almost like when you're looking at leaders making a decision. Any decision is better than making no decision at all. Be decisive, and that's the first part of the observe. Perceive the threat, look at the potential indicators, and perceive if there's a potential physical action that needs to take place. If I hear gunshots or something that sounds like gunshots, and I'm in an area where that would be completely out of the ordinary, I, you know, as a gunfighter, as somebody who's been trained by the U.S. military to save lives, if I'm carrying concealed, I'm running towards the gunfire. If you're not in that capacity and you're a civilian, you're not armed, you're with your family, you need to grab your family and move in the opposite direction. And don't be that deer in the headlights where you're trying to figure things out and you're like, I'm going to wait for it to transpire. I'm going to wait for things to like happen more. That's how people get killed. And you'll become that, you know, I talk about the 10-80-10. You'll be that 80% that wind up killed because they froze. That's all. A little bogged down and digressed a little bit, but I think it's important that we talk about that. Next time, I'll tell you the P in the acronym, and we'll go from there.
Yeah, I think that's a great piece of advice, Mike. And and like you said, if you're in that capacity where you don't have the ability to react, you know, through your training or through your career, or you're not armed, the best thing to do would be to move immediately away. And I think that's a great piece of advice that the listeners can take away, you know, if you fall in that category. So, you know, and like Mike said, on the next episode, he'll continue to get into this for those of you who are interested in the mindset. So, we had a great episode today. I really enjoyed it. I just want to thank Scott for coming on and sharing some of his experience. And as always, you know, we appreciate the feedback and the listeners who are helping us continue to give you guys a good show. So if you have any questions, for anyone who has any questions about anything they heard on the podcast, you can send an email to podcast@globalrecon.net. And as always, you know, we respond to every email, we respond to every direct message, and we try and answer questions on the show. In case anyone has those same questions, then they can have the questions answered for them. So that was the end of the show. You know, we're going to wrap it up now. Mike's website is fieldcraftsurvival.com. His Facebook is Fieldcraft LLC, and his Instagram is Soft Survivor. That's SOF Survivor. My website is globalrecon.net. My Instagram is IG Recon, and my Facebook is FB Recon. And Scott, can you throw out the website for your brother and his social media handle?
Yeah, absolutely. So my brother's, you can hit him up on Instagram. It's at CrossFit No Surrender, all one word. And then you can reach him at www.crossfitnosurrender.com. And if you guys have anybody has any questions for myself, I'm kind of getting new to the Instagram thing, but you can find me at, it's all caps, Scout, SCOUT _ pilot, PILOT 58. That's Scout _pilot 58. If anybody has any questions for me, you can hit me up on Instagram. Or if you have any questions, you can also email them to me at jabroni, JABRONI _5@hotmail.com.
Nice. All right. So that's it. We'll see you guys in a couple of days. Peace.